The problem occurs when we're doing everything in our power to protect ourselves from things that challenge those prejudices, those biases.
You're listening to Good is in the Details. I'm Gwendolyn Dulski.
And I'm Rudy Sallow.
And this is the podcast where we learn what we didn't know in the spirit of Socrates, all with the aim of a more knowledgeable life, a happy life. And in this episode, Rudy, I definitely learned what I didn't know. I think that the term rhetoric, when somebody uses the term rhetoric, I had a very narrow definition or idea in my mind. And even when somebody uses that word today, they use it kind of in a disparaging sort of tone, like, oh, that was just rhetoric. Well, there is a whole field of study devoted to rhetoric. And on this episode, we are going to learn about language, its effects, and what is the study of rhetoric from a rhetorician.
Yes, I am not a smart man, and I must use the Google dictionary a lot. So looking up the word rhetoric in the dictionary, it says, the art of effective or persuasive speaking or writing, especially the use of figures of speech and other compositional techniques. For example, he is using a common figure of rhetoric, hyperbole. A similar definition is language designed to have a persuasive or impressive effect on its audience, but often regarded as lacking in sincerity or meaningful content. Yeah, I don't know if those apply to this. Not helpful. Yeah, it's just Rudy being not helpful. I don't really know if I'm helpful on this episode. I give some tidbits about what the advice I give to law students and other people out there. You know, we call it the Facebook rule. Never put anything into writing that you would, you know, your jaw would drop or your career would be lost or your friends would be lost if it ever showed up on Facebook. You know, be careful of what you put into writing. But that also is not totally the point of this episode. Look, I don't know what the point is, but we learn what rhetoric is academically. It's academic, and then there's Rudy's version. And Rudy's version is always the weird version.
We were students on this episode, and we have a fantastic scholar, author of, fantastic, and I can tell that she must be an awesome teacher. She wrote a book called The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, Professor Robin Reams. And she is a fantastic scholar. I really enjoyed her insight. I absolutely like the way that she sets up the book. The ancient Greeks, the way in which they were exploring and learning about language and its power, and how the more we know about that, the better it helps us today in our everyday lives when we're getting information or when we're having conversations with friends and family members. So we're all about living the good life here, you know, through intellectual growth. And we've got intellectual growth on this one. Tony Macanta, this is another one for you, by the way.
I took the what was discussed here about those ancient Greeks, and I whittled it down to a Rudyism of just don't put anything into writing that you never want to come back and bite you in the ass, which I think, you know, if you go back a couple thousand years, that's what the ancient Greeks were saying. That's what I think.
It's practically there. Yeah. And just before we get started, I want our audience to know that we have got a contest. Well, let's see, a giveaway. It's not exactly a contest, a giveaway. What we want you to do is take a screenshot of either this episode or your favorite Good is in the Details episode and tag us. Put it in your IG story, tag us on Instagram, Good is in the Details Pod, and we have got a gift for you. We partnered up with Intelligent Change, and they've got something special for you for one of our listeners. So remember, screenshot of this episode or your favorite episode, IG story, tag us, boom, first one to do it gets their gift. Okay, and now let's talk about rhetoric with Professor Reams. Robin, welcome to Good is in the Details. We're going to be talking about your book today on rhetoric. It's called The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times. How perfect. Well, let's start at the beginning. What is rhetoric? What do we mean by rhetoric? And how is it a whole study? I noticed in your introduction, you were like, you have to explain to people how it is a whole field of study. I always thought of it as the art of persuasion, but what is that to set us up for understanding your book?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. And thanks for having me and for giving your time and your attention to the book. Great first question. In part, I had to address that from the outset in the introduction, precisely because that's really the first thing. That's the first sort of prejudice I think I have to overcome when I tell people what I study, because on the one hand, people tend to think they know what rhetoric is. And what I mean when I say rhetoric is different from that, from what people seem to think they know rhetoric is. And it's, in my mind, it's not just persuasion, it's that, but it's more, but often when the term rhetoric is used, not in a neutral sense like persuasion, but in a pejorative sense, it's meant to refer to manipulation, lies, bullshit, things people say but don't mean, manipulation in words to control people's thoughts and lead them away from the truth. These are some of the various ways that the term rhetoric has been used since the term was coined by Plato. But when I use the term, I'm using it to refer to a longer tradition and a discipline of rhetoric. And so most people don't really think of the term rhetoric and associate it with its longstanding kind of 2,500-year-long history as a discipline, largely because that discipline sort of disappeared. It fell out of fashion. It sort of came to be seen as an academic vestigial tale in a way. It sort of it was reduced to ornamentation in the modern era, and soon thereafter came to be seen as somewhat obsolete when writing replaced speaking as the sort of métier of academic discourse. So those of us who study rhetoric see its continued value because at the inception of the tradition, all the way back in ancient Greece, it was used to study language. It was really the first discourse on language. It was the first discipline devoted exclusively and entirely to the study of language as language, to study the many forms and figures of language, what language can do, how language provokes belief, guides action, dictates thoughts, and all the sort of philosophical and political fallout from that influence. That was always rhetoric. The idea was that through studying those forms and those figures and the power of language, not only could a student of rhetoric learn how to use it and wield it, but also they'd become a lot cannier. They'd become a lot more critical, a lot more cautious, and therefore less easily duped when people also use those tricks. So those of us who study rhetoric are still studying that same material. We're studying how language has always been used and how language is used today to create exactly those same kinds of effects. The medium may change. The medium might not be, you know, oratory from the floor of the assembly in Athens. It might be on Twitter or X or Instagram or social media, but it's still very much the same forms and figures are present. They're still working. The problem arises when we're not paying attention to them.
I like how in your introduction you describe rhetoric. You say that it's about, you know, language patterns and thinking, and it's described as non-passive, understanding how persuasion works. It's also to evaluate the way the position attempts to gain agreement. And I think that's so fascinating. I think it's really an incredible way to pay attention to, you know, marketing or the news, where you can, let's say, look at different media outlets and see the exact same issue kind of come to the fore, but it depends on how it's highlighted or spoken about that will get you to think about something, like whether something is a problem or a crisis or worthy of our attention, or if it's just belittled that it's not that important. So it's not only for us to be able to use, but it's also for us to see how other people are using language to make us think in a particular way.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's even primarily about that. I think one of the fundamental misunderstandings about rhetoric is that its purpose is that we learn rhetoric so that we can learn how to advance arguments, make cases, be persuasive, speak more eloquently. And it was always that as well. But its greatest power is revealed not so much in that, but in being able to identify when other people are using those tools and those skills of rhetoric, and to become more self-reflexively aware of how that can work its power on us, almost like magic. And yeah, as you mentioned, agreement. I mean, I address the issue of agreement in a few different ways in the book. One is the way that you just described. I mean, we can really only begin to have productive, deliberative conversations about things when we begin from a place of agreement. Now, that doesn't mean that we're necessarily agreeing on every perspective or even every outcome, or that our conversations, our debates are going to terminate in the same place. Not everything aims at full and complete agreement, but we have to have at least some foundational agreements, even if they're as meager as the idea that these issues that we confront as a society, and today, you know, as the second title of the book reflects, it's difficult to do this in such a polarized political climate, but we have to at least be able to agree that there's something worth having a debate about, something that it's worth our disagreement, it's worth our dispute. Rhetoricians see that as a kind of agreement. They see that as a powerful starting place for deliberation.
I'm wondering, how is it, if a person is really steeped in a point of view, how do you recognize that you are steeped in a point of view that you have been persuaded to come to, instead of just what constitutes truth? Like, how do you even get out of that bubble?
Well, I think what you just described is the starting place. It's not by any means the end place, but it's definitely the starting place in my classes, but also in the book when I teach some of this material. One of the things I try to get my students to recognize is when they have been persuaded of something, and it doesn't even have to be as strong as that, but that the first step really involves noticing, to begin with, noticing the effect of language, noticing that something I'm hearing or something I'm reading, an argument I'm consuming, is pulling me in the direction of wanting to believe it. And sometimes that can be just as surface level as feeling a sense of satisfaction at having something I think is true confirmed or having it reinforced. When I teach this material with my students, and it's something I discuss in the book as well, that's always a starting place. That's always a sign that there's room for a little bit more critical analysis, a little bit more rhetorical analysis. So then the next question becomes, all right, so what is it in the language that provoked that response? That response didn't come from out of nowhere. It came from somewhere. Rhetoricians have all the way back to the beginning, all the way back to the inception of rhetoric in the ancient Greek tradition. That's where it started. I mean, rhetoric was born at the same time that literacy was introduced in ancient Greece, precisely because all of a sudden there was a material object that could be empirically studied in the form of a speech, literally written on the papyrus. Interlocutors could sit down together. They could look at a speech that previously had worked an almost magical effect on them, created belief in them, that propelled them to action. Now they could sit down and study it. They could pay attention to the words that once had kind of evaporated the minute they would go out of existence the minute they're coming into existence. They're evaporating as the speaker is speaking them. Now they're fixed. Now they're on the page. Historians of rhetoric believe that that's what accounts for the rise of rhetoric, because when you can study the actual words on the page, then you can identify it was these words that created that effect, those words that created this different effect. Then you can begin to develop patterns. You can understand what the relationship is between the language itself and the belief it provoked. That, in essence, is rhetoric. That's how rhetoric starts to work. The first step that I was just describing, that kind of noticing my belief, it's not an easy step to take. Our general tendency is to think that, well, I'm believing it because it's true, or I'm believing it because it's right. That's our natural tendency. And our natural tendency is not to think, I'm believing it because those words were effective. I'm believing it because those words were persuasive. So then rhetoric inserts itself as a sort of synapse into that process. So then you can begin asking, why am I propelled to believe this? What in the language causes me to find it to be so persuasive? Rather than just assuming that the language is a sort of clear glass on the truth, and therefore the reason I believe it is because it must be true.
In your intro, you're talking about this distinction between your point of view and your father's point of view. And I'm so glad you put that in there, because I think a lot of families are in this position. We're at an impasse. The points of view are so different that we're having trouble even having a conversation with each other, because it's not just a matter of disagreeing. It's a matter of finding another person's views just abhorrent. And I noticed on my own part, I'm part of a gym, LA Fitness, and they have different locations. And when I'm at that gym that's in Los Angeles, around in the city, I noticed what is on the television there. And there's a big variety of things that are on the television. The only news channel available is CNN. When I go to the same LA Fitness, but in a different location in Orange County that's more conservative, every other television is Fox News. They have a couple on CNN and not much of a variety, which means that if you're planted on one of these machines for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, you're staring straight at just one point of view, and there's not even access. Like, these two different gyms don't even have the other media playing in their spot. Mm-hmm. And it was just making me think about, how can you just be less than 30 miles apart and have these two communities that look at the world so differently? And the reason is because that's what's available. That's what they're absorbing. But I also have to be humble in my own point of view and just think, what if I am wrong about X? what is another way to understand X?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's one of the things in having read the introduction, you would have read this as well, that one of the ways I approach that issue in the book, and I think one of the reasons I included in the book this idea of the hermeneutic circle, which I'm sure you're familiar with, mm-hmm. idea attributed to Martin Heidegger. But one of the reasons I included the idea of the hermeneutic circle, and the idea of the hermeneutic circle, is it's pretty straightforward. It's that any act of interpretation, any time that we engage in understanding, approaching, absorbing new ideas, new information, there always has to be a set of pre-understandings. And we have to be able to understand even that we're encountering a new idea. We pick up a book to read. There's so much pre-knowledge you have to have before you can make any kind of sense out of a new book. And the more complicated a new book is, the thicker that pre-understanding needs to be. But the idea of the hermeneutic circle is really that pre-understanding is necessary for absorbing new information, but it also can become a shield on understanding new information when we're too reliant on the hermeneutic circle. And one of the reasons I wanted to include this was because there was so much talk in the time that I was working on this book about the problem of confirmation bias in the way we consume news and the way we encounter new ideas and the way our opinions take shape on current events and public affairs. The reason I wasn't crazy about that idea is confirmation bias is essentially that, you know, in any time we're absorbing new information, we often go out and intentionally seek information that confirms our pre-existing beliefs. And so we're only really allowing in the data that reinforces a prior understanding, a prior point of view. And one of the reasons I was dissatisfied with that explanation of contemporary culture is precisely that, but everybody has to have that. We have to have some way of making sense of the world. We have to have some biases. We have to have some predilections. The problem occurs when we're doing everything in our power to protect ourselves from things that challenge those prejudices, those biases. And by prejudices, I don't mean prejudices against other people in the way we often use that term. I mean prejudgments about the world, understandings about what existence is, about the nature of reality. We can never come to understand anything with a completely blank slate. So one of the reasons I wanted to include that understanding is that it's perfectly okay to have some pre-understandings. It's perfectly okay to engage in some acts of pre-interpretation anytime we're taking on information. The problem is, you just really beautifully described it, Gwen, is that sometimes we're shielding ourselves from contrary points of view. We're shielding ourselves from points of view and ideas that would call into question aspects of our hermeneutic circle that might cause us to make some adjustments to it, to change some of those pre-understandings and those pre-interpretations. So really, the aim of the book is to give the reader some simple tools for being able to do that for themselves, so that ideally their goals will change. The goal would change from doing everything to protect my pre-understandings, my predilections, my biases, to trying to figure out ways in which my own biases and my own pre-interpretations and my own pre-understandings might be hindering me from encountering new ideas that are challenging in themselves.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how sometimes people will dismiss what a politician says, like Trump, for example, as, oh, that's just him talking, as though the words don't matter at all. From your point of view, is Trump good at rhetoric? At being persuasive with his language choices? Or is he a genius at this? Or what's going on there? What do you think?
So I generally try to avoid, I mean, I love the question you're asking, because you're asking me something different than I often get asked. People want to know what my opinions about the content of the words are. And I'm always trying to say, well, why do you even care what my opinions are? Who cares what my opinions are? I'm much more interested in what's going on in the language. But at the same time, I'm also much more interested in just being able to describe what's going on in the language, or being able to describe why it's effective to people. And that's slightly different for me from evaluating it, whether it's good or bad. What's more interesting to me is being able to trace the effect from, you know, rhetoric A to outcome B. And I think what I see when I look at somebody like Trump is something that, again, this is dating all the way back to the beginning of the rhetorical tradition in ancient Greece. His rhetorical maneuvers are things that ancient rhetoricians knew were powerful and effective. The first chapter of the book actually takes on this issue. It aims to explain why it is that we have this starkly divergent and contradictory response to Trump in political rhetoric. On the one hand, there's just no question but that so many of the things that he says are just false. They're lies. They're not true. And yet at the same time, his words have such a powerful and profound ring of truth to so many people. His followers believe him to be truthful. They believe him to be a truth teller. And in the first chapter of the book, I try to explain why that's the case. The common explanation for people who are his followers is that, you know, the fake news media is out to get Donald Trump, and so they call him a liar because they hate him. The explanation for people who believe Trump not to be telling the truth is that, well, his followers are stupid, right? They're duped. They're suckers. But in fact, I think what we have in this case is actually two radically different notions of truth, not whether what he's saying is true or not true, but two fundamentally different definitions of the word truth, both of which have really deep historical roots in the Western tradition. One of them dates back to Plato, and the other one dates back to before Plato. When people point out Trump's lies, the falsehoods, what they're working with is a notion of truth that is representational. It's a correspondence theory. Again, Martin Heidegger referred to this as a correspondence theory of truth. It's when the words are supposed to be declarative statements about the world, and they're true when they match up with the world, and they're false when they don't match up with the world, when they fail to correspond to it. But in the ancient rhetorical tradition, and before and even while and during, Plato was developing this correspondence theory of truth for various other political reasons of his own time to try to silence the falsehoods and the ways that falsehoods in his own political moment had circulated. There was an understanding that truth needed to be a revealing. It needed to be a disclosing. Truth needed to be an unconcealing. And one ancient rhetorician who was a contemporary of Plato's noted that that happens best, and it can only really truly happen when a speaker speaks extemporaneously, off the cuff, without the aid of a written speech. Anytime a speaker is speaking with a written speech, it's a prefabricated thing. It's not revealing anything true. It's not revealing the speaker, who they are, their heart and their soul. It's not revealing what they really think and a moment of authenticity in front of the audience that's right in front of them. And so we have, you know, these two notions of truth that go all the way back. They each have more than a 2,000-year history behind them, propelling them. And what we see in a phenomenon like this is that they both are still at work. They're both still at play. I mean, obviously, the correspondence theory of truth, which sort of took over the Western idea, the Western conception of truth after Plato, but that didn't fully put to rest or put to death or nullify this ancient, older notion of truth that's rooted in the oral tradition, the pre-literate tradition. And I mean, it's really actually very fascinating to read Alcidamas, that's the rhetorician I was referring to read his treatise on those who write written speeches, because his treatise really sounds like the same kinds of arguments that you hear today against things like AI. Mm-hmm. It's a false speech. It's not that it doesn't have the living, breathing soul of the human in it. It can't ever be real. It's not really truly speech. These are the same sorts of questions that rhetoric was bringing up at the very beginning.
This episode is sponsored by Factor. What could Factor actually be? Well, let me tell you, Factor is a great way to eat healthy and take charge of your health and what you put into your body. Basically, eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal, so don't put these into the freezer. These are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. I did the Keto. I could go on and on about all the delicious meals that I had had. All six of the ones that I ate were filling and left me energized and ready to work out and go throughout my day. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons that help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Honestly, what are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. There are two-minute meals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. No prep. No mess meals. Factor meals are ready to heat and eat. There's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. flexible. Today is all about flexibility. We're working from home. We're working from here. We're working from there. It fits to your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every single week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries at any time. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Thank God, because I am such a bad cook, I could burn cereal. That's right, I could burn cereal, but not Factor. Factor is the perfect solution for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Sign up and save. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/details50. That's factormeals.com/details50 and use code details50 to get 50% off. That's code details50 at factormeals.com/details50 to get 50% off.
I'm thinking something that's not as controversial as politics, but I've been reading a lot lately about the way that the medical community has historically described women's bodies. And the terminology that's used is to essentially with this idea that they're inherently inferior. And so all of the words that are used to describe women is as though they're in contrast to what would be a normal body, which be a man's body. So descriptions of, let's say, a woman who's having trouble getting pregnant, that her uterus is described as hostile. Things like that. And so I'm just trying to think of other ways in which the terms we're using, that they are really setting up a whole, like you said, a pattern of language or a whole viewpoint of how, let's just say, for instance, how women are understood by the medical community and as agents, completely different. But I think this chapter on truth, it really fascinated me because I was thinking about how many times people seem to be debating over what is the truth, and yet we don't even have a definition of what constitutes truth in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the aims of that chapter in particular is to suggest, I mean, one of the aims of every chapter really is to show how oftentimes the things that we're debating, the surface level issues we believe we're debating, and we're ready to slug it out over whether Trump's a liar or Trump's a truth teller, there's a deeper divide, there's a deeper discord, there's a deeper question. And those deeper questions are actually things that we not only are not really talking about at all, but we might actually find ourselves not to be so pitted. We might not feel quite so acrimonious or so pitted over the question of how are we using the term truth differently? How are we responding to things in the world as though they're true, as though they're not true, in such a way that it reveals we have a divergent understanding of what truth is? So yeah, that chapter and in all the chapters, my aim is really to show if we shift the discussion away from the topics we believe ourselves to be debating onto the rhetoric in which those debates are being carried out, it reveals something to us about our assumptions, but it also reveals something to us about the possibility of establishing more common ground on the basis of the rhetoric. Yeah, and the example you just gave, I mean, one of the things that just came to mind in your description of women's bodies as hostile is the way that's almost constructing a narrative out of women's bodies. And that's another one of those techniques that I discuss in the book in one of the chapters, is the way that we wouldn't necessarily think of that as a kind of storytelling, but if a woman's body is hostile, then like as a rhetorician, that makes me think, oh, this setting up the woman's body to be the kind of the antagonist in the story, right? The woman's body becomes the villain in the story. So then you have to wonder, well, who's the protagonist? Who's going to save the day? And now I want to know more. I want to know more about how that story is being constructed.
Yeah. I've just gotten wrapped up in this because one of the classes I do is on current debates in sexuality, and we're kind of going into a bit of the way the medical community has described women's bodies. And I do this thought experiment with the students of like, imagine if the woman's body was considered the norm, how would the man's body be described? So the woman's body is always described in this negative fashion, you know, underdeveloped, she needs to be pregnant, that's what she's for, she's weak, she's moist, I mean, all sorts of stuff like that. So let's just flip it and say, what if the woman's body was the norm? How would we describe the man's body? And it is pretty funny, but it's so ingrained to think of women as smaller and weaker that, you know, I don't know what came first. The legitimate fact that they're generally smaller, and then you've got all this language to describe how that's an inferior and a weak trait. So I've been fascinated with this. But Robin, I have to ask you something. I'm feeling sheepish. I'm wondering if this is dumb.
You know what I always tell my students? There are no dumb questions, there are only dumb people.
Okay. That's great. You're better than me. I've told my students, I say, I think one of the biggest lies that we've told people is that there are no stupid questions. I'm like, there absolutely are. But you're better than me. Well, this is my question, because rhetoric obviously has to do with language. So I'm feeling sheepish by asking this. Is it possible to look at film or images as rhetoric as well, even though it's not language? The image. Okay. So that
I don't, but people do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a whole field of rhetoric called visual rhetoric, and it examines in various ways from multiple formats how images function rhetorically, how images function persuasively. So yeah, it's a whole field of study. It's not really what I do, but it's interesting stuff. And yeah, there's a vast literature on that.
Okay. Well, Rudy in, I'm going to pick on Rudy in here, in law, what do you think about language and rhetoric? Do you have any questions about being persuasive? The rights and wrongs. What about the moral questions of persuasion? In law, you essentially have to work on rhetoric. From a legal point of view, how do you identify rhetoric from truth?
You know, the way I talk about this with my students is that words matter. Obviously, words matter. I was like, yeah, okay, so what's the point? Well, what that means is never put anything into writing that you would cringe if it ever showed up on the front cover of a newspaper, right? We constantly talk about, you know, is this something that would be better said over the phone rather than putting into writing into an email? We try to teach that skill. Maybe that seems obvious to people, but maybe it doesn't. You would think like, well, of course, a lawyer's always going to put something in writing. Like that's what lawyers do. They're going to type up an email. They're going to send a letter. And while in general, that's true, there are times where you never want to put anything in writing, sometimes even advice to a client, because you always need to anticipate potential litigation. In every deal that you work on and everything that you do, you have to assume that someday what you just put into writing will be placed in front of a jury. So whenever you write anything out and you press send, first of all, you can never get it back, but you must anticipate a jury reading that someday. And how does that relate to what you're saying? Well, a good example of this is something that I taught my class about yesterday. There's a famous case of the reason why the Angels baseball team in Anaheim, there's a reason why they were called the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim for many years. It was because in the contract that was between the city and the Anaheim Angels, there was some ambiguity in the contract as to where the name Anaheim needed to be placed. A party can take words, take a writing, and interpret it into a way that serves them if there is any ambiguity in that writing. So rhetoric is important, truth is important, but being able to manipulate something in writing for your own benefit is part and parcel of the practice of law. So I'm constantly trying to teach people, always anticipate somebody else, some third party in the future reading anything that you write down and using that against you. Maybe you're thinking, well, that's crazy. Like, how could you live like that? How could you practice like that? How could you have a job like that where you're constantly worried every single word that you put into writing could be used against you? Well, that's what it's like being a lawyer. And that's why we're high strung. And that's why we're all crazy. And that's why we have, you know, the lawyer unhappiness is super high, because we live and die in this strange world of quote unquote truth. Truth, what's the context? Everything is contextual. A word being used in a particular way in a particular contract can be manipulated. It's a constant struggle to determine what truth is when you are practicing law, and you just need to anticipate no matter what you say, no matter what you do, it will be twisted to serve somebody else's purposes if they want to do so.
So then this brings me to Robin. So what are some of like the moral ramifications, or how do we approach rhetoric with ethics and goodness in mind? Or as Drew Dalton will talk about, evil. Is there any evil with rhetoric?
Well, I mean, I guess what I like to say about that is that that's not my job. I have to leave that to the ethicist. And that's not really a cop out. It's that that kind of question actually leads away from effective rhetorical analysis in my mind. I mean, I think what's interesting to me about Rudy's example is there's a kind of latent assumption in it. I mean, this is the kind of thing a rhetorician, I'm paying attention to your words, Rudy, and I'm thinking about what kind of assumptions are lying under the surface of it. And there's a latent assumption there that what that means is that something that your words can only really be attached to you if they're in writing. Your words, if you're speaking, are not attached to you. They're not an extension of you. And it goes back to that distinction we were identifying between Trump supporters and Trump's opponents and two different concepts of truth and the fact that Trump seems to prefer to speak off the cuff. His discourse is not in writing. His discourse is spoken. He doesn't like written speeches. If he has them, he goes off script. And it just so happens that he will say something and then walk away from it and act as though he never said it in the first place. Whereas the exception really is when something's in writing, well, then the words can be reattached, right? Then the words, somebody can be held to account for their words. As a rhetorician, I'm less interested in deciding like what the morality and the ethics of that might be or evaluating it on those grounds as opposed to evaluating the effects of that. Yeah, and the effects of that, I mean, we can acknowledge is it means that it gives Donald Trump a certain facility with walking away from his own words, of detaching himself from the things that he says. And it's possible for me as a rhetorician to observe that and to notice that without seeing my job as being a kind of finger wagging. And again, like I say, that's not a cop out. It's not a way out. It's just if the aim is to morally or ethically critique someone, well, then I'm moving away from just paying attention to how the languages function. And then I'm undercutting my ability to identify why it's powerful, how it's powerful. Because I've moved into the realm of ethics and evaluation in that sense. So I think that doesn't mean that it doesn't have moral effects, and that doesn't mean that there isn't an ethical overlay to that or an ethical problem as a result of that. It's just that I would say at that point, when I get into when the conversation moves into a more prescriptive, ethical, morally prescriptive direction, well, then you're no longer doing rhetorical analysis. You're doing something else. You're doing ethics at that point.
For the record, I just want to make sure that I'm not being called unethical by telling people to be very careful before they put in anything into writing, right? Is that... That's not unethical advice. That's anticipatory advice. Would you agree with that point, Robin?
No. I what I was suggesting is that it reveals a fundamental assumption that's different from the rhetorical tradition. It's a commonplace assumption today, not just for attorneys, but for anyone, that we can detach ourselves from our words. That things were different in the ancient rhetorical tradition. In the ancient rhetorical tradition, there was an enormous amount of shame attached, for example, saying something that was false or saying something that would have been proven to be untrue. We don't carry around that same level of social shame. Yeah. We don't carry around that same idea that our words are sort of an extension of ourselves. And one of the reasons for that, I mean, there actually are historical reasons for that, and they have to do with the rise of literacy. The words become externalized because they're put onto the page. The rise of literacy that I was talking about is also being a reason for the evolution of the field of rhetoric. And so consequently, we could come to see it has sort of cultural, historical effects that we come to see language as not an extension of ourselves, not an extension of our very bodies and souls. And so it's just interesting to me as somebody who studies language to hear a lawyer talk about that perspective on language, that really the language is yours when it can be proven materially to be yours because we have it in writing. Whereas for an ancient rhetorician, the language is yours because it's yours and you said it, right? And they didn't have the same sense of detachability from their own words. Their words were perceived, whether they were in writing or not, as being their very own. One of the reasons we have a proliferation of, you know, what people like to refer to as proliferation of untruths in the post-truth era is precisely because we have this sense that we can just walk away from our words. We can even deny that we ever said them in the first place. We can have a sense that they're not actually ours unless they can be proven to be ours or pinned to us in that way. So yeah, I'm not engaging in any kind of ethical evaluation of you, Rudy. I can't.
Yeah, no.
Peer into people's hearts.
No, I'm actually, I'm pleased that you made made that distinction. I guess maybe my example wasn't per se the best one for this discussion. I guess I was trying to kind of whittle it down to practical advice that lawyers provide to their, the professor provides to their students or to their younger associates is be very careful with whatever words that you put into writing and always anticipate that some third party is going to read them. And perhaps some advice is best said verbally, not for the fact that to deny them, but if you're worried about future litigation or if you're worried about the introduction of certain evidence, because written words, even of themselves, even if they are, you know, attached to you, can be manipulated against you, even if there wasn't an unethical intent or anything that you were trying to do there. So just that's always my advice. Always be careful about anything that you put into writing, into texting, into social media, into anywhere.
Would that we were all that careful when we speak as well, right?
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say that because it's interesting. Much like words in certain contexts in a writing could be twisted for ambiguity, sometimes words are said because someone is feeling certain emotions and those emotions get the better of them. And sometimes it's just not practical to count to 10 before you speak or, you know, walk away and don't talk to somebody. Sometimes you are going to engage in emotional conversations. That's called being a human being. That's called being a part of a society. Sometimes we as human beings say things that were driven by emotions that you were feeling at that time. The emotions are saying those words, but you're not. And yes, of course, there's consequences of that. But I think we do still need to have some grace and like put into context, wait a minute, why did this person say this at this particular time? What were they feeling? What was going on in their life? What was happening? Should I give them the benefit of the doubt? What's their history here? So, you know, we're humans at the end of the day.
Yeah, Robin, I think I want to, yeah. I'm thinking about this, I think I might be in my own bubble here because the whole idea behind the podcast is to learn what we didn't know we didn't know. And I am having a hard time divorcing the notion of rhetoric from an ethical position. So I think that I must be far too influenced by the apology, by this idea when Socrates is speaking of like the prosecutors, they rested their case and it was just all rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to tell the truth. And so I might be walking into this thinking you cannot divorce the art of persuasion from an ethical point of view, which means that I think I'm missing something on rhetoric. So what am I doing wrong, Robin? What am I doing wrong?
You're not doing anything wrong. You're not doing anything wrong. You sound like a good Platonist to me. One of Socrates's biggest intellectual foes, at least as dramatized by Plato, was a sophist named Protagoras, who was one of the first teachers of rhetoric in Athens. One of the debates, as I'm sure you know, between Protagoras and Plato was this question of whether something is true. So Plato has Socrates go to the mat again and again and again with rhetoricians and sophists because he's so troubled by the fact that there are people who can teach students how to speak convincingly and compellingly on subjects that they may or may not know anything about. And so they can be persuasive from the floor of the assembly about invasions or shipbuilding or wall building or medicine or anything and not know the first thing about it. So this is what Socrates really just can't get over. And Protagoras's response is, you want to call it truth. You want to be obsessed with this question of truth. But what good does it do you to talk about it in terms of truth if when in reality what you're talking about is more something is more expedient than something else? One thing is more effective than something else. One thing is more practical than something else. You, Socrates, want to highlight and prioritize truth above everything, where in reality what we're talking about is preferable, more expedient, more functional, rather than truth. And so Protagoras kind of went down in history as being, the Western world's first relativist. But I don't think that's what was going on with Protagoras. I think what Protagoras was interested in was the fact that everything in politics is contingent. Everything in politics can only really ever be probable. I mean, there may be certain geometrical realities that can be established with a sort of scientific rigor and certainty, but that doesn't apply to politics. Politics are, it's social. it's changing, it's carried out between humans, it's unpredictable. One person does thing and it does one thing and it sets the course or changes a set of outcomes for everything else, for other people. And so when you want to smack truth onto politics in the way that Socrates wanted to, Protagoras would say, well, you're wasting your time. You're much better off figuring out what's going to be practical rather than what's going to be true or what people would take to be true. So you're absolutely not right for wanting to couple ethics and rhetoric. Aristotle certainly did. Plato certainly did, or at least Socrates certainly did, according to Plato's dramatization. That is really the story that won. That was the way that Aristotle formulated the discipline. But for the sophists, it was something slightly different. I mean, they saw one of the things that they wanted to emphasize. Protagoras, for example, said, look, you can't do politics without language, and language, just like everything else in politics, is constantly changing. So if you want to prioritize truth, you're going to end up coming up short. Another sophist named Gorgias said famously, words are not the things themselves, right? We have this tendency to think that when we're using words, we're using language. There's a direct correspondence. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the words we use and the things we supposedly are discussing. The sophists wanted to draw attention to words precisely because they had such powerful effects and precisely because our natural tendency is to assume that what we're talking about is the thing themselves. So this isn't a kind of argument for a sort of lazy nihilism or a extreme relativism. It's an argument in favor of paying attention to what the language does, what the effects of language are. That doesn't mean that you, an individual person who begins to study more rhetoric, doesn't eventually move on to also consider consider ethics and morality as well. A rhetorician wouldn't tell you not to consider those things. A rhetorician would just tell you, well, that's where the study of rhetoric ends and the study of ethics and morality begins. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Again, I really love how you started out your book by giving this very personal window into the reality of rhetoric, like how that impacts our relationships and how we understand each other. And then you go into the history. And I just think that that's it's very accessible. It's a good way to get people interested in thinking about the impact that their language or their mode of thinking can have just, you know, at the kitchen table. I think it's great. Robin, thank you so much for coming on Good Is in the Details. Tell Drew we say hello.
Thank you. Thank Will you. Do. Will
thank,
do.
Thank you, Robin.
Yeah, thanks, Gwen. Thanks, Rudy. You'll have a good day.
Good Is in the Details is produced by Dr. Gwendolyn Dolsky and Rudy Salo. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please scroll down to the bottom and hit that 5-star review. And remember to go to our Instagram for your chance to get our surprise gift from Intelligent Change. First person to take a screenshot of their favorite episode or this episode tags us and you get your gift. We'd like to thank AvonmoreInc.com for sponsoring this episode of Good Is in the Details. If you play bridge or any of your friends play bridge, you have to check out AvonmoreInc.com. They have everything for your next bridge party. Throw that party. Get the coasters, the tallies, the smart color playing cards. Go to AvonmoreInc.com and let them know that Good Is in the Details sent you. You can also check out our Patreon for extra content, join our book club, and get a shout out for us when you sign up. Patreon.com/Good Is in the Details. Okay, until next time. Bye.